The sequence for our classes is that we have first moral theology, and then we have a break, followed by the course on the liturgy. First of all, I'm very happy to be able to come back. I got permission less than a month ago to return to Chicago for this coming year, and I notice a few new faces. For all of you, just to remind you that the understanding is that there is a regular attendance so as to maintain continuity in the course. Let's go over the outline just briefly on moral theology. The purpose of this course is to explore certain dominant themes in Catholic moral theology in order to better understand our own responsibility toward God and to be of greater assistance in helping others live out their Christian commitment. So the purpose of the course is understanding. In the nature of things, there are so many problems, moral cases they are called, that we can't begin to explore in a course like this. My hope is to cover the essentials. Moral theology is the science of human actions insofar as they are directed by natural reason and divine faith to the attainment of man's natural and, for us, supernatural destiny. I think we can skip most of this because this is part of my early lecturing on the subject, except to go down to our aim in the course will be to cover these two levels of Catholic moral teaching, namely, as stated in the earlier paragraph, the universal principles, and then go through the commandments. Note, however, under commandments, we have three levels, not just the Ten Commandments. We have the precepts of the theological virtues. We have then the Ten Commandments of God, and then the precepts of the Church, including canon law. Needless to say, we will not go over all 2,200 canons of canon law. I understand, by the way, on very good authority from the Holy See, that the new code is coming out, certainly, next year. As the Holy Father just told the people in charge, I want this finished, and I understand it is done, but is being now revised and finalized. The textbook for the course, strangely, is the Modern Catholic Dictionary. I have over the years, as I've told my students, I've consoled myself that this is not pride, but I have never in all my years of teaching ever used anyone else's textbook. In many cases, in teaching Jesuits, I would have my own set of notes, which then, later on, I would publish at least parts of them. There are two advantages to having your own material. First of all, you don't have to qualify or comment on or least of all criticize the textbook. Common sense will keep the teacher from criticizing his own product. But secondly, no course, no matter how detailed or lengthy, and 2 hours, say, every 2 weeks, in moral theology, doesn't begin to cover what needs to be known. With a book or books authored by the instructor, and this is the philosophy that I've operated on in all my years of teaching, that what you receive and what you read is an extension of the lectures. In other words, I save time by teaching for just 2 hours and then asking you to read for for as long and as much as you have time for. Okay? There are several hundred definitions in moral theology. There are almost 6,000 definitions in the dictionary. So I would estimate 400 or 500 would be a fair estimate of the number of definitions in the field of moral. Besides the dictionary, which I will be asking you to use also in the liturgy, I will also indicate certain small publications, generally documents of the Holy See, dealing with moral issues. One thing I would like to have all of you obtain, I understand there are 8 copies available here, on Declaration on Certain Questions Concerning Sexual Ethics, published by the Holy See. I want all of you to get a copy of this. Use up whatever copies we have. They're available from the Daughters of St. Paul. There are some very important principles stated here in moral theology. Declaration on Certain Questions Concerning Sexual Ethics. The area covered by these documents is far larger than just sexual ethics. The nature of sin, comparison of mortal and venial sin. I want all of you to have a copy of this. However, in lieu of all of you having copies of this, I want you, for the next time we meet, to come prepared to read the chapter on morality, chapter 9 in this book, also authored by your instructor, Christianity the 20th Century. So this book, in paperback, chapter 9 on morality. Your reading assignment for our next class is on morality. Chapter 9, pages 437 to 477. 40 pages. It would take hours, days in fact, to cover this matter in class. My hope is you will digest it, and you won't be surprised that you will have a quiz on chapter 9 of this book. It's a deceptively short chapter, 40 pages. It especially deals with the problems facing Christianity in the moral order. Okay?
Do the daughters also have that?
Yes. In fact, they got the copyright from Doubleday, and when Doubleday, I took a copy to Doubleday, when they saw the price on the back of the book, they said, we'd go out of business in 1 month if we sold our books at the price the Daughters of St. Paul sell theirs. It's very good binding, incidentally, both in paper and hardback, and the price is very reasonable. And I get no cut. In fact, this may interest you. The Daughters of St. Paul never pay me any royalties. I had to get permission from my provincial. This was a new one. But they don't pay royalties. At first they promised to give me 200 copies of the book. Then when I was in Boston to sign the contract, no royalties. They said, Father, you'll notice where it says copies, we left a blank. We promised you 200 copies. Would it be all right if we gave you just 100? At any rate, so I get 100 copies. Those are my royalties, covered by permission. Suppose we cover the textbook situation now before we get into the course proper. I will periodically tell you what I want you to buy. I want you to all get a copy of this. Okay. Now, you don't have to buy a copy of the Christian of the 20th Century if you already have a copy. If you don't, you can borrow one. Or, of course, if you wish, buy one. Secondly, and I had a hand in this, published by the Daughters of St. Paul, Morality Today, The Bible in My Life. Simple, down to earth, and very useful, especially for young people. Okay? Morality Today presents the biblical approach to God's precepts in a personal style. Okay? Simple, and I hovered over this enough to know that what's in here is well done. Okay. Then, this is a useful pamphlet of some 30 pages by Cardinal Kroll, Religious and Moral Values. That doesn't mean religious persons and moral values. It means religious and moral values. The adjective covers the one word values. Again, talking especially about the problems, for example, the decisions of the Supreme Court in the impact on American morality. It's a hard-hitting thing, very quotable, facts here you don't find anywhere else under one small cover. Okay? Cardinal Kroll's A Right to Know, Religious and Moral Values, on sale by the Daughters of St. Paul. Okay? Then anticipating what we're going to cover in the class, we'll see more about abortion, but this is one of my pamphlets called The Sanctity of Human Life. And it sells for a thin dime, which is 1/6 of subway fare in New York. What is the fare in Chicago now? 70. Also 60 cents? 70. 70. Must be a conspiracy. 70 with a transfer. In any case, The Sanctity of Human Life, it is very useful, especially for pro-life people, synthesizes the Catholic teaching on why human life is sacred from the first moment after conception. You should all have a copy, if you don't, of Humanae Vitae, of Paul VI's document. Again, I presume it sells for a dime, at any rate. That's what I would sell it for. Published by the Daughters of St. Paul. Okay. Any questions before we go on? Okay.
What did that contract say about commission on sales of publications?
No, there is no contract.
Who the author of Morality for Today?
Morality for Today. Oh, it's the Daughters of St. Paul. It's a joint. Many of their publications are done by them as a group, with such assistance as they get. In this case, I was involved in helping them.
Okay. I want to know that second book.
Please?
Beginning, that second book you mentioned to us right at the beginning, it's the green one, but it's the thicker.
Christianity in 27.
This one you mean?
No, the other one.
Christianity. You mean this one?
No. The green one.
This one? Is it green?
your book on Christianity in the 20th century.
Christianity in the 20th century.
No, the other Declaration
on Certain Questions.
Oh, you mean this book?
Declaration on
Declaration on Certain Questions Concerning Sexual Ethics.
Oh, it's just a pamphlet. Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's not a book. It's a pamphlet. Sells for 20 cents. By the way, good books in moral theology are not easy to come by today. Now, there's one book that I recommend, but I would not require. Volume 2, I don't believe it has been translated into English. But Volume 1, General Moral Theology, published by the Daughters of St. Paul, by Lanzi and Palazzini, two bishops, two Italian bishops. It's the only textbook I could recommend in moral theology today in English.
Could you spell the next second name?
Lanza, L-A-N-Z-A, and Palazzini, P-A-L-A-Z-Z-I-N-I. Palazzini. And as a good supplement, if you want to get it, price, whatever it is, paper, $3. $3. Mm-hmm. And cloth, $4. 250-some pages. So, Volume 2 is very good, but still in Italian. The sales, unfortunately, haven't been that good, and this, as you know, inhibits the publication of books. At any rate, a very useful and not too difficult Volume 1, this is, on general moral theology. But complement and supplement what we cover in class.
Just yes. One more question. Would that be considered, the one that has been translated, would that be considered all right for a high school text?
Yes, yes.
Not too
yes.
difficult.
Very, it might be a little bit, but I don't think so. The English, well, the original language, but the English is, I think, for example here, the education of the weak conscience. There are in particular two weaknesses that it can habitually affect the judgment, conscience in his judgment, laxism and scrupulosity. And then they talk about a lax conscience and the opposite, scrupulous conscience. So I think it could be used, at least in the upper classes of high school. Okay. I've understood that for certain, Father Charles Kern, who, as you know, is the best known and most notorious moral theologian of the country, he is under formal investigation in Rome. At any rate, things are looking up. Any further questions? Now my methodology. I've taught moral theology from a variety of perspectives. I have decided, and I will use the notes of one of my students, and I've got the system of shorthand on the left so I can read the notes. I've decided for this class to teach moral theology catechetically. I will give you questions and answers. The field is so vast, and the most important thing I believe in moral today is to make sure you've got it straight. We will end up, depending on how fast we go, how many questions you raise, and how long it takes me to answer them, between 400 and 500. It should then be, hopefully, if you take notes carefully, be a catechism in moral theology. Okay? Now, it'll depend really on you, because there's a lot of matter. The plan is that I will first give a question. Now, that raises problems, because somebody will not catch it. If I repeat myself, I use up time. You understand what I'm saying? The same with the answer. I will then give a question, and these have been carefully worked out. Then an answer again, in as few words as can be to justify an answer, reply to the question, and then a commentary. For most of the questions and answers, there is some comment. Some cases the commentary is rather detailed. I'll see how well we go, how fast we go. I will try to not talk too fast. One advantage, if you are so inclined, would be we have recorded material from this course. I will try not to go far afield, but remain concentrated on the specific question. I suppose I don't want to rush this, and consequently, I suppose all you can tell me periodically is whether you're kind of getting it, right? And that's the best, because I don't think that we can afford going verbatim over the answers and making sure that everybody has things down in precise verbal form. You agree? Otherwise, we spend a lot of time. So, now, look, what I can do, of course, I can choose and pick and not try to cover the matter. You see? I do have, and again, I'm guessing when I say this because, see, you are the first audience of its kind that I've taught moral theology to. I've always taught this either to priests or to those studying for the priesthood. And consequently, I presume on a lot. What I have thought I would do, and see how you react to this. I taught a course, not this one, but a course in moral theology for 5 years at a state university. And as I regularly do, I put together a book for my students at the state university. I never published the manuscript. I brought the first 30, is it, or so pages of the manuscript with me. It's single space, so it's quite a manuscript. You are welcome to copies of that manuscript. But remember, the course was taught, first of all, a few years ago, when I taught at a state university. It is directed to college students, and it deals with issues that, well, are especially relevant to them. There's a whole chapter on drink. You can't imagine how much there is on sex, page after page. There's a great deal on contraception, abortion, euthanasia. All right? Now, I don't want to, because we'd have to make copies of it. I haven't done it yet. We'd have to, make copies available for everyone. Suppose, before today is over, we find how many of you would want, is that fair, do you think? See? What would it come to about, sister?
Well, around $7 with the
about, she tells me, about $7. Is that what you paid for the notes on grace? It's got things in there that I haven't published anywhere. I think it's a useful thing to read. It's quite a sizable manuscript. But I would not want to build a course just on that. Notice? In any case, if you would then somehow let me know, what should we do? Shall we? A raising of... Well, you might be embarrassed.
Out in the library, Father, for them to
please?
Sign. We can put a sheet of paper in the library.
Would you please? And just jot down your name, that you would want a copy of the mimeographed, whatever we do with it, offset of my unpublished manuscript in moral theology. Can I start? I guess I can. First question. What is Catholic moral theology? By the way, if you know any shorthand, it would help. At least even your own homemade shorthand. I will talk as slowly as I can, but naturally, I don't want to keep repeating, or because then we'll have to change the nature of the course. You get it? Those for whom this was assembled had to get it, you know, with complete accuracy. And I have plenty of time. We don't have that kind of time here. What is Catholic moral theology? I don't think I have to repeat Catholic moral theology is, okay? It is the science of human actions insofar as they proceed from reason and divine faith and lead to man's supernatural destiny. What is Catholic moral theology? The science of human actions insofar as they proceed from reason and divine faith and lead to man's supernatural destiny. You see, therefore, that moral theology, this is now commentary, okay? I will always tell you, question, answer, and comment. If I run too far ahead, keep me informed so that we cover the matter, and then I may have to adjust. For example, I might want to drop some of the questions. I want to cover the matter. And the commentary in some cases is pretty important. Moral theology, therefore, is a science. Therefore, it's an organized body of knowledge. There are different sciences. Each science differs from another in having different object or purpose. The science of chemistry, of course, is the composition of matter. The study of physics is the study of the forces of matter, of material energy. What is the object? What's the focus of moral theology? It is human actions. Now, I don't know whether we go into human actions. I don't think we do. So what I think, and this is another reason, I will draw up by next week, or next time we meet, I'll have a list of the definitions from the dictionary in moral theology that I'll expect you to read, and then we'll always occasionally be quizzed on it. Okay? Like, what's a human action? Okay? You'll notice immediately, when we say human actions, we mean those actions that a person does by using his mind, where the action is performed because the person chooses to perform it. So that, in plain language, a human action is every action a human being performs which is free. Whatever we do that we would not have done unless we wanted to do it is human act. What's moral theology? It is the science of all those actions. But notice, we said, proceed from reason and divine faith so that the choice that I make is not only based on reason, it is based on reason plus reason and faith. That's why conscience, which most textbooks will define conscience and tell you, it is the human reason or human intellect making decisions in moral matters. For a Catholic, that is an incomplete definition. Conscience is not only human reason. It is human reason enlightened by faith. Thus a Catholic cannot say, well, this thing which the Church tells me to do is unreasonable. Maybe it is, by merely human standards. A Christian defines conscience in terms of reason and faith. Okay. Moral theology, therefore, looks at human actions from a very distinctive viewpoint. Where do they lead? And, for moral theology, human actions are part of the study of moral insofar as they lead us to our supernatural destiny. Okay. Question 2. How does moral theology differ from moral philosophy or ethics? Or, if you wish, how does morality differ from ethics? Both words are used, and I dare say most people use them indiscriminately. The answer. Moral theology differs from ethics in that its principles and norms are derived not only from reason, but from divine faith assisted by God's grace. So moral theology, or morality, differs from ethics in that its principles and norms are derived not only from reason, but from divine faith assisted by God's grace. And consequently, the word ethics is incorrect when applied to what we're studying. Aristotle, centuries before Christ, wrote a very famous and still useful book called Nicomachean Ethics. Now, ethics is the science of human actions, but those actions based only on reason. But we add one more point. This is all commentary. By the way, I should break and tell you exactly where the answer. Am I clear enough? Okay. Maybe I should change my voice or step aside or something like that when I'm commenting. One big difference between morality and ethics, because it is based on faith, is that not only do I know from faith and not only from reason what I am to do, but faith tells me I have more than my own willpower to do it. Am I clear? I have divine grace. And in fact, it would have been unjust on the part of God to have revealed moral obligations and bound his followers, say in Christ's case, to obey them unless he had provided the means, otherwise known as grace, to keep those precepts. Shall I pause for a question or two? Okay. Question 3. How does moral theology differ from dogmatic theology? As you know, theology in general is divided into two major areas. dogmatic and moral. Moral theology differs from dogmatic theology in that it is not mere reflection on revealed truth. Moral theology differs from dogmatic theology in that it is not mere reflection on revealed truth, but is concerned with the revealed laws of God. Semicolon. Not only to tell us what these laws are, but how they are to be kept. Not only to tell us what these laws are, but how they are to be kept. So far, the answer. Now the commentary. The theology on grace was a class or course in dogmatic theology. What's grace? Divisions of grace? Forms of grace? And so on. This is different. And does someone have a copy of the New Testament? It is well to know that Christ's last statement, as recorded in Matthew's Gospel, just before his ascension, says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore make disciples of all the nations, baptize them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teach them to observe all the commandments I gave you." That is Christianity. It is no mere philosophy or no mere theology. It is a way of life in which Christ told us, through his apostles, to observe or obey what he commanded.
Father, what is the chapter and verse on that?
It's chapter 28, verse 20. Verse 20. Chapter 28, verse 20. Happens to be the last verse of the Gospel. Then to encourage us that it won't be impossible, he added one more sentence. "And know that I am with you always, yes, to the end of time." And we say, "Lord, thanks. We sure need you." Okay? Good to hear, isn't it? There is a great deal of truth we are to believe. But the purpose of Christianity is not merely to believe. It is to act on what we believe. Otherwise known as observing the commandments. Question 4. Now, with apologies for these technicalities, but I think if I didn't do them, something is liable to come up later on, and then I fault myself for not having given you a previous question. Question 4. How does moral theology differ from ascetical theology? How does moral theology differ from ascetical theology? Maybe how does MT differ from AT, depending on your hieroglyph system? Moral theology differs from ascetical theology in dealing principally with what is preceptive and obligatory by God's law. Moral theology differs from ascetical principally, or it differs because it deals principally with what is preceptive and obligatory by God's law, period. Ascetical theology deals mainly with the counsels, S-E-L-S, with the counsels which God has not prescribed, but which he invites his followers to practice. Ascetical theology deals mainly with the counsels which God has not prescribed, but that he invites his followers to practice. Period. That's the answer. Now a brief commentary. Moral theology is the science of the duties of a Christian believer. It's the science of the duties, what we have to do to be saved. Ascetical theology is the science of Christian perfection. A person takes a vow, which by definition is something I don't have to do. I told this yesterday, it's worth saying here today. Two men, both educated New Yorkers, good Catholics. I had counseled the one for some time. They came to visit me. They'd called beforehand. Neither married. They wanted to take a vow of chastity. I said, fine. I knew the one, and I figured, well, I think he can keep it. He brought his friend along, who also wanted to take a vow of chastity. But I thought, just as a formality, we'd talk a little bit, just to explain a little bit about, well, what's the vow of chastity. So I started out by saying, now, fellas, I suppose you know, kind of jokingly, you're not taking a vow to keep the sixth and ninth commandments. They looked at me. Say that again. So I said, when you take your vow of chastity, it is not to keep the sixth and ninth commandments. Are you serious? They asked me. Why, of course. So then I proceeded to explain. Nobody takes a vow to keep a commandment of God. I mean, it's kind of pious if you do it, but it's not a valid vow. It's like telling the Lord, I know this is a commandment, but big, generous me. I promise to keep your commandments. And the Lord says, you better. Vow or no vow. So I proceeded to tell them, if you take the vow of chastity, you vow not to marry. Well, I could see they were not interested in making a vow of chastity. They both left happy, but they didn't take the vow. All right? So that's ascetical theology, which this is not. The course we're taking is not a course in ascetics. Question 5. Just so we don't miss anything, I mean anything that I consider worth covering in class. Number 5, how does moral theology differ from mystical theology? Answer. Moral theology deals with man's responsibility towards God rather than with God's reward. Moral theology deals with man's responsibility towards God rather than with God's reward to man. Mystical theology, still the answer. Mystical theology is the science of the divine gifts, especially of contemplation and union with God, which he confers on his chosen souls. Moral theology deals with man's responsibility towards God rather than with God's reward to man. Mystical theology, on the other hand, is a science of the divine gifts, especially of contemplation and union with God, which he confers on his chosen souls. Okay? In other words, some people, because of their generosity towards God, are specially blessed by him, say, with a gift of contemplation. And some with ecstatic, mystical experience. Except for having had question 5 on the subject, we will not treat of ecstasy in this course. Just to make sure that we define our limits. All right? Question 6. How does moral theology differ from canon law? How does moral theology differ from canon law? Without repeating the question, moral theology concerns itself exclusively with man's interior conduct. Moral theology concerns itself exclusively with man's interior conduct. Canon law is directly concerned with man's external conduct. Insofar as that conduct affects society. Once more. Moral theology concerns itself exclusively with interior conduct. Canon law is directly concerned with external conduct insofar as that conduct affects the society in which the person lives. Let's just say a few words. Canon law has, as I think I mentioned earlier, some 2,200 canons. There are prescriptions like in civil law. Frank, would you say that civil law is concerned with man's interior behavior? You do something wrong, if it's considered wrong by civil or state statute, it's wrong. But I didn't intend to. You've got to prove it. So canon law concerns itself with the external conduct. Now I should add, because we won't touch canon law again, all right? See, I'm just zeroing in on what we're going to cover. And once we enter, you might say, the precincts of moral theology, then of course we'll begin expanding, but then we'll know what we're talking about, that we're not talking about, for example, canon law. The new code of canon law, as I mentioned earlier, is due, so I am assured, for publication next year. We will have occasion to look at some canons just to illustrate the Church's thinking. But the canon law that we have, and that we will have somewhat revised next year, concerns itself with the duties that a baptized person has. Canon law touches only the baptized. Is every baptized person affected by the code of canon law of the Catholic Church? Yes. Well, they don't believe in the Catholic Church. Well, it's too bad they don't. They are still covered by canon law. The Church considers every baptized person as her member. And therefore, just as the United States considers those who live here are her citizens, if they don't behave themselves and not citizens, they can be put out of the country. But the members of the society called the Church are all the baptized. whether they're Catholic or not. And canon law affects them. Moral theology, otherwise than canon law, concentrates on interior conduct. Now that interior conduct can affect the external too, and we will deal with that, but only insofar as it is an internal act, a decision of my free will, is it the immediate scope of moral theology. Any questions? Okay. Yes.
Father, I had a question about of any Christian that's baptized, because I had thought that in the Protestant religion, that when the minister baptized, he didn't baptize with the intention of ridding the soul of original sin.
Well, I would say, provided the person has been validly baptized, there are really only three conditions necessary for valid baptism, absolutely speaking. Number one, the one who baptizes must use water, and the water must flow, and it must flow on the head. Any other part of a body, for example, caesarean section or other difficult deliveries, there's danger of death. Say the feet are baptized in case of danger and the child is born dead, it is a doubtful baptism. So it must be the pouring of water and for certain baptism on the head. Secondly, the Trinitarian formula must be pronounced. The words, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, while the water flows. And thirdly, there must be some faith in someone behind the baptism, even though not in the very person baptizing. A mother might ask the doctor, say, to baptize her baby, who say is in danger of dying. Provided that person, third condition, provided that person has at least some intention to do what Christ wanted done when he commanded to baptize in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, even though the one baptizing is mistaken in interpreting what Christ wanted, the baptism, the Church tells us, is valid. Okay?
Father, just one more question. About baptizing, is it all right if the godparents are divorcing one or the other, or should you pick godparents who are divorcees?
Well, they... No.
Really?
They shouldn't be. Now, of course, there are divorced people that are in very difficult condition, and they can be very holy, right? So just because a person is divorced doesn't mean the person is not living a good Catholic life. May have been deserted by, say, the husband and the poor woman with her children, she can be living a very holy life. But the person should be a good practicing Catholic.
So, but what if the Catholic Church allows people like who have been divorced to be godparents, or...
Well, of course, the priest should be careful and instruct, say, the parents to make sure that the godmother or father, or both in fact, are good Catholics. If either he is careless or doesn't even raise the question, and the godparents are not good Catholic, that raises the problem of raising those children, because if the parents default, it's the responsibility of the sponsors. That's the reason. Question 7. By the way, we'll have to also time ourselves, because 400 questions is a lot of questions. So we'll have to figure out about how long this takes, and we'll have to budget ourselves. Today may not be a normal day, at least, so we know how much we're covering. Question 7. How does moral theology differ from pastoral theology? How does moral theology differ from pastoral theology? Moral theology applies to all Christian believers. Pastoral theology concerns itself mainly with the care of souls. Pastoral theology concerns itself mainly with the care of souls, incumbent on those who have an established office in the church. Pastoral theology concerns itself mainly with the care of souls, incumbent on those who have an established office in the church. Pastoral theology, therefore, you might see as that part of moral theology that bishops and priests are to know. All right? Their responsibilities, which we will not go into in this class. Before I go on, I might tell you, one of my intentions is to publish this as a manuscript, but I have a variety of duties, and the manuscript is almost 2 years old, this one that I'm sharing with you, but has not been published. Any questions?
You say moral theology applies to all Christian believers. Are you limiting?
Well, as such, of course it applies to everyone, but clearly, as a science, the science of morality applies to everyone. But moral theology as a science assumes that those who study it are Christian believers. Otherwise you'd have to, well, defend almost every other sentence. And one of the assumptions of teaching a class, you don't have to defend your premises. Number 8. Let's try to cover 10 and then take our break, okay? What is distinctive about Catholic moral theology? What is distinctive about Catholic moral theology? Catholic moral is distinctive in recognizing the Church's hierarchical authority. So, Catholic moral theology is distinctive in recognizing the Church's hierarchical authority to identify and interpret the moral principles and norms of reason and revelation. To identify and interpret the moral principles and norms of reason and revelation. The word moral covers both principles and norms. So the distinctive feature of moral theology, the one that we will be taking, is that it recognizes the Church's hierarchical authority to identify and interpret the moral principles and norms of reason and revelation. Years ago we didn't have to stress the adjective Catholic in front of moral theology. We had better stress that today. Everybody, it seems, and his brother and young sister has his and her own theory in morality and calling themselves Catholics. In other words, this reason and revelation needs to be interpreted. A priest like Charles Curran teaches that contraception, abortion, and euthanasia under certain conditions are permissible. There better be someone to interpret Charles Curran's teachings. pray, by the way, for Archbishop Hickey, who, as you know, is the new ordinary of Washington, in which Catholic University is located, and the deadline is December the 31st, 1980. Because the 1st of January, 1981, the document issued by Pope John Paul on Sapientia Christiana, the norms by which pontifical faculties like Catholic universities, the norms by which they must be guided, takes effect. Archbishop Hickey's time is running out, and he has a lot of homework, because come January the 1st, if Catholic U does not shape up, knowing the present Pope, he will have to tell the American hierarchy, sorry, your university will not be allowed to give any ecclesiastical degree. And since most of their students are clerical students, they will be deprived of the charter which the university has. All right? And Charles Kern, among others, of course, are on the faculty. Number, question 9. What are the main divisions of Catholic moral theology? What are the main divisions of Catholic moral theology? The main divisions are, first, principles, that's P-L-E-S, derived from reason and revelation. First, principles, derived from reason and revelation. Second, precepts, given to us by God and the Church. Precepts, given to us by God and the Church. And third, means, especially the sacraments, prayer, and penance. Principles derived from reason and revelation, precepts given to us by God and the Church, and the means, especially the sacraments, prayer, and penance. Just a word about each. The principles, of course, are the basic teachings of the Church, and known from the natural law of reason, of what, for example, we are to direct our consciences by. Precepts, whether given by God and found in revelation directly or by the Church in her by now many preceptive teachings, especially in canon law. And third, the means, especially the sacraments, prayer, and penance. But notice, when we talk about the sacraments in this course, it's as means to keeping the moral law. When we talk about prayer, it is as a means of keeping the moral law. When we talk about penance or self-denial, you just try to keep the moral law for 24 hours without self-denial and see what happens. Can't do it. Question 10. I didn't know the question was here, at least I had forgotten it. It's here. So I may repeat one or the other thing we've seen before. What is a human act? Question 10. What is a human act? A human act is an action which proceeds from the free and deliberate will of a human being. A human act is an action which proceeds from the free and deliberate will of a human being. Commentary. We may therefore, if we wished, define moral theology as the science of human freedom. Not every action that we perform is done freely. Not few things we do, we get into the habit of doing without, as we say, a second thought. Moreover, there are degrees and degrees of freedom in performing an action. And lest we forget, because there are several thousand things I'd like to share with you in this very syncopated two-semester, twice-a-month course, which is 4 years in the seminary. The one thing I'd like to share with you at this point is that, ideally, the more freedom we place into our actions, the more pleasing they are to God. That doesn't mean we go around with a notebook reminding ourselves, so that every time I perform an action, I make a deliberate and willful decision. I am hereby, look at my watch, performing this action with complete freedom. No. But I think a lot of people, especially in a brainwashed country like the United States, it's been said, and I think it's true, most people, most of the time, do not perform really human actions. I think often people committing crimes, they don't realize what they're doing. And in a country like ours, with a media brainwashing our nation, thousands of hours of radio and television, millions of pages accumulatively in a given year of print, who anymore thinks for himself? And if you don't think for yourself, you don't act for yourself, because there is no freedom without forethought.
Father, what you just said, could it be possibly applied to, say, I'm thinking of someone in particular, a young couple who get into this, thinking about divorce and remarriage?
I think, yes. I think, and as a priest, Father Downey, I think, can verify, my apologies. I think this is the time to do it before I say another word. Father Downey, would you want to say just a few words? I feel like a heel. Father Downey, James Downey, is a Benedictine. You cannot imagine how happy I am that Father Downey has come to Chicago, because the Institute on Religious Life has needed someone who is in charge of the office and is, well, chaperoning things and all kinds of questions and problems with over 100 affiliates we've got. Father Downey is the National Coordinator for the Institute on Religious Life. And say a few words, please, Father, with apologies.
I don't think I'd have come to class if I known I was going to cause all this distraction. I am glad that Father Hardin recruited me for this job. Not that I expect it to be easy, so please, I know you're already praying, but since you've seen me, you know you should redouble your prayers. I also learned, I studied under Father Hardin in St. John's in New York, and I learned that whenever he had a class, I can always learn something, so that's why I came today. I also wanted to meet you people that are attending the class, because I know we'll be working together on many projects of the Institute. So as I said, keep us in your prayers, we need them.
Thank you. I would like to ask you to remember Father Downey's brother, who is his abbot, who died a week ago Wednesday, right? Abbot Brendan Downey also passed away a week ago Wednesday. Would you please remember him in your prayers? Father Donnie, knowing him, will keep tab on you because there is a lot to be done, and the Holy See wants lay people involved with the Institute on Religious Life. The spiritual life and sanctity is for all of us, right? And not just. What a safe statement for priests or religious. Thanks, Father, and my apologies again for being preoccupied. Well, we covered 10. Let's take our break, okay? Make a sign of the cross in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Come back soon. Just to get things going, let's make a sign of the cross. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. It was recommended, and I think it's a good idea, that we'll go for a half an hour till 3 o'clock as planned, and then immediately begin the course on the liturgy. I have my notes on the liturgy.
Is it that folder I gave you? That white folder?
Number 11, are we responsible for all our human acts? Are we responsible for all our human acts? Yes, we are responsible because responsibility implies that we do something knowingly, willingly, and freely. Yes, we are responsible because responsibility implies that we do something knowingly, willingly, and freely. In other words, and this is one of the basic statements in this course, every human action is a moral action. Every human action is a moral action. Now a bit of commentary. The essence of responsibility is that I know what I'm doing, I want to do it, and I do it. The time factor is immaterial. In many cases, a split second is enough. The essence of morality is knowledge, desire, and choice. Number 12. Is knowledge necessary for moral responsibility? Is knowledge necessary for moral responsibility? Yes. We must first know that something should be done or not done before we can be held responsible for the action. Yes, we must first know that something should be done or not done before we can be held responsible for the action. Period. Nothing is ever willed unless, or nothing is ever willed before it is first known. Nothing is ever willed before it is first known. Now a bit of commentary. We might ask, to what extent is knowledge necessary to be responsible? some knowledge is required. Clearly, we can never fully know the implications of any action we perform. Now, this is going to be especially important as we analyze the meaning of mortal sin. And this is one reason why I asked all of you to get copies of this document on certain questions concerning sexual ethics, issued by the Holy See and confirmed by the late Holy Father. Because there are those now in the field of moral, nominally Catholic, who claim that unless a person fully realizes and fully intends to reject God, no matter how grave or otherwise morally serious the action may be, a mortal sin is not committed. In other words, people can commit fornication, perjury, adultery, abortion, you name it. And just because they perform what is morally wrong, though they know what they're doing, they have not committed, so the logic goes, a mortal sin. The man who started the theory is, I regret to say, my own confrere, Karl Rahner, who was of very high reputation, but his very reputation makes such theories as this one so devastating and put into practice.
Is that the one that is called the fundamental moral option? Is that
yes, that's the fundamental moral option. Now, we'll talk about that at length. I just want to briefly mention how important it is to clearly understand what responsibility is. I do not have to be fully aware of the consequences of my action in order to be responsible. Number 13, is willingness necessary for moral responsibility? Is willingness necessary for moral responsibility? Yes, we must want to do something. We are responsible not only for the immediate action, but for the consequences of that action. Yes, we must want to do something to be responsible. And then we are responsible not only for the immediate action we perform, but for the consequences of the action. In other words, I choose, say, to tell what I know is untrue. My untruth is morally wrong. As a consequence of my untruth, someone's reputation is gravely damaged. Because, say, the untruth that I said was about some person or that person's character, which gravely injured that individual. Now watch this. I am responsible not only for my act, but its consequences. But clearly, my responsibility for the consequences depends on my foreseeing those consequences. All right? Now, we won't go into many of the ramifications, but just to mention the fact. There is, however, such a thing as ignorance, about which we will speak in time, for which a person may be totally not responsible. However, say the consequences of one of my actions, which I don't foresee, I cannot automatically say that because I have not foreseen Therefore, I am not culpable, because maybe I should have foreseen. We don't want to go into all the ramifications. I just want to tell you and give some... You're just dealing with the bricks and mortar now, you see? And the whole first part of the course, principles, my hope is you will, well, not find it too difficult, and I hope above all not boring. But we've got to get these principles down, otherwise when we come to talk about the commandments, we'd be completely at sea. We won't even have the vocabulary. Number 14. What is the freedom necessary for moral responsibility? In other words, what is moral freedom? So what is the freedom necessary for moral responsibility? The freedom that we're talking about is the power to either act or not act, or to choose some one thing in preference to others. Period. A simpler, it's still the same answer which I've added to the first one to kind of nail it down. Freedom is the power of choice. Freedom is the power of choice. Now some commentary. Because freedom is the power of choice, it is important for us to ask whether everything we do is done freely. No. Not everything that, as we say, happens to us, or in us, or even is done by us, is done freely. For example, the metabolism of our body. There are many reflex actions for which we are not responsible. And since one of the conditions for freedom is knowledge, unless I am aware of what I am doing, I am not acting freely. However, it is well to know that not only, you might say, interiorly or invisibly, but even in our bodies, there are certain actions that we just never do unless they have been done freely. We have voluntary muscles and involuntary muscles. Digestive muscles are involuntary. But what I cause those muscles to do can be quite voluntary. Others are voluntary. Mention three muscles that are voluntary. Brother, please.
Any kind of volition.
So, the hands, right? Want to drop my hand, I drop it. Raise my hand, I raise it. One muscle or set of muscles we'd never perhaps advert to as being voluntary. The muscles, well, of the face, the facial muscles. You want to smile? We smile. Want to frown? I frown. When I tell people, and I've told you this before, so this is among friends, that I try to go to confession every day, people tell me, Now, Father, by the looks of you, I don't think you're that bad. What do you have to say? Well, for example, the control of my voluntary muscles. Somebody hurts me. My natural reaction is to show displeasure or anger. But I know enough moral theology to know that I'm responsible for the way that I respond. Maybe just a moment, but I'm responsible for that moment. One of the most voluntary faculties of the human person, I've discovered, is the mind. I'm sure you've been told, if you want to think, you think. And you don't have to be a teacher to know this. If people don't want to think, they won't think. You'll smile. Oh, some of the most rapt attention I've got from students. They were lost in paying attention to whatever was on their minds. A question, and you find out they were elsewhere. The internal powers that we have are subject to the will. And among the areas of moral theology that we're going to look at some length is our responsibility for our thoughts. Number 15. When are we responsible for the evil results of our free choices? When are we responsible for the evil results of our free choices? There are three, you might say, occasions or conditions. First, when we foresee the results. When we foresee the results. Second, when we have a choice about the human action we perform that we foresee will have certain consequences. And third, when we are obliged to avoid the evil result of our human action. When we are obliged to avoid the evil result of our human action.
What was the second?
The second, when we have a choice about the human action we perform that we foresee will have certain consequences. Please? When we have a choice about the human action we perform now that we foresee will have certain consequences. Let me close this and I'll make commentary. The subject, by the way, as you gather, is going to get deeper or, from another viewpoint, steeper as we go along. By the way, I'm not losing anybody, am I?
Not so true. You have to have them in order to lose them, buddy.
Now, let me be real honest with you. Look, I just want to help. We do have an option regarding this course. The option is to teach the course that I taught at the State University. All right? Where I kept these things down to a minimum, All I can tell you, I think they were juniors. College undergraduates, junior year, are not, by and large, scientific theologians. So, we'll do what we can, but I do want to be of help, all right? And tell you what we'll do. We'll find out next week. What I might do is ask some questions that, well, will reveal to me how many of you got, I don't mean the words, but the basic ideas that we're trying to cover in class now, in this way. And I'm hoping, or really hoping, one of my dreams is that you will all get not only passing grades, but high grades to make up for last year. Some comment, yes, Lucy.
When we go into the confessional, will a confessor likely to say, I'm sorry, no more confessions for today?
Well, you might even help out a confessor or two. A bit of commentary on question 15. No action, human action, we ever perform is ever done in absolute and complete solitude, just that action. Every human act has consequences. Remember that. You cannot think a thought without its having consequences. You cannot say a word without its having consequences. And often, the most serious consequences are not those that affect other people. You think certain thoughts consciously and deliberately. You are changing your mind and affecting your personality for life. Even therefore, our interior thoughts have consequences. We then can be responsible not only for what we do, but for what can happen because of what we do. And in relationship to others, every human being is on display. The media to which we are so widely exposed. This is the reason for them. The people behind the media are not only out to make money, they are mainly out to influence people. And consequently, what they portray, and given the magnitude of the audience, this, by the way, is what Pope Paul VI said is the gravest crisis in the church today. Communications. Any questions before we go on? Okay. Number 16. What factors lessen the responsibility for our human actions? What factors lessen the responsibility for our human actions? They are mainly four: ignorance, concupiscence, fear, and violence lessen the responsibility for our human actions. Ignorance, concupiscence, fear, and violence lessen. We might ask, what factors affect our responsibility? There's a difference between lessening the responsibility and affecting the responsibility. Among the factors that affect our responsibility are emotion and passion. But theologically, the word concupiscence covers everything. So, among the four that lessen our responsibility is one called concupiscence. This affects our responsibility. It also lessens the others. Do not necessarily affect, except to lessen. Number 17, what is ignorance? Ignorance is the lack of morally necessary knowledge. Ignorance is the lack of morally necessary knowledge. Commentary. Notice immediately. Ignorance is more than just not knowing something. Ignorance, for our purpose, is knowledge that should be there. De facto, the person doesn't know. But ignorance as a moral element means the lack of knowledge that should be there. That's why I say morally necessary. There is a duty to know certain things. If the person doesn't know, that's the kind of ignorance we're talking about, where he should know and doesn't know. Thus, there is knowledge that this person, in this state of life, should have. Married people should have certain knowledge. They are morally responsible for being ignorant of certain things that married people ought to know. Priests, certain knowledge they should have. Number 18. What are the principal kinds of ignorance? Now, by the way, I apologize once more. We have to go through this vocabulary. Yes, Tom?
You didn't describe faith in violence.
Please?
Fear.
Oh.
Fear.
Fear. You didn't describe fear and violence.
No, we're going to. We're going to talk about all of these.
I thought you meant.
Yeah, see. Well, this is... We won't miss a thing, Tom. Now, let me just pause for a moment of commentary. For lack of what I am sharing with you, that's why most people, otherwise educated, are sheep in our country. They allow themselves to be led by others who know what they're doing, know exactly what purposes they have. But their number, the number of leaders in any nation, is always small. And this, what I'm sharing with you, is not even given, sadly, in many seminaries today. No wonder people tell me, religious especially, they go to confession and the confessor tells them, come back when you've got something worthwhile confessing. So that the principles will have to be certain terms that are technical, so that when we talk about various kinds of sin or obligations or virtues, and words will be used which are the words of this science, it's a science. That what we'll talk about will make sense. Number 18, let's close with this one. What are the principal kinds of ignorance? Though the moment I give you the answer, you'll say, well, give us more because you haven't explained it. And the other questions have to do with the explanation. There are 6 principal kinds of ignorance. In case you were ignorant of the kinds of ignorance there are. There is antecedent or consequent ignorance. Antecedent or consequent ignorance. There's just 2 big words for before and after. But that's the vocabulary. Second, there is ignorance of the law or ignorance of the fact. Ignorance of the law or ignorance of the fact. And third, there is vincible or invincible ignorance. There is vincible or invincible ignorance. And I think, rather than complicate this, let's stop here, and I want to comfort you by saying that, well, this is the course as of now, and what I'll do the next time we meet, first of all, I will have some kind of a revealing quiz that will let me know, you know, how well you've done. In fact, what if I do this, just so we all know what we're about? The reading assignment stands, okay? What is it, chapter 9 of Christianity of the 20th century? But the quiz will be on these 18 questions. Is that fair?
Yes.
Now let me tell you. The questions will not be so you will memorize, you know, just you remember certain words. Try to ask questions, and I'll even say a prayer that the Lord will help me to be real honest. I'll ask questions which will indicate to me that you're getting what this is after. Doctor?
Will you be in the future elaborating on this difference between an earlier question there, willing to do an act and actually doing the act?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Now, look, I could have spared you all this, but then we wouldn't have the vocabulary that we'll need. Now, what we might do, but of course I'm trusting to human nature, I could, for example, send you to the dictionary and tell you to memorize some of these definitions. I repeat, having taught for a number of years, I found out some things people just don't do. Well-intentioned, generous souls, they just don't do it. Let's see what happens then. Are we clear? Next time, then, you read chapter 9 on morality and Christianity of the 20th century, you'll be quizzed. You'll be quizzed on these 18 questions and not on answering, you know, for example, what is ignorance? That should be an easy question to answer. What I don't know. Though a better answer is what I should know, right? Okay. I'll try to put it in such domestic language, and you use ordinary vocabulary, because all I can tell you is to know moral theology is to learn a great deal, especially to cope with today's confused world. So then if I don't even want to make a condition, My fond hope is you will do so well that while I may have to do something with these questions so as not to burden you with a lot of note-taking, to make it as palatable as possible, that we will teach the course. I have an option, by the way, to give you the notes for the course that I taught to the undergraduates, but I'd like to think that you are all capable of getting a little more than I gave the undergraduates. Am I fair in talking this way? Okay. Well,